Mr. Murray Lee, real two.
Real bastards. It's very easy to be critical about one's own nationality, but what I'm saying is that the nationals of any country can produce the type of people who were in the Gestapo and who worked for people like Goebbels. This isn't common to Germany or Japan, who are our enemies, or the Russians with the KGB. It's any country, given the wrong sort of government, can produce all these nasties. And after all, you look at the way the flying pickets operate nowadays, even this week, and they're the sort of people that would be in the English Gestapo, because they're nasty types.
Now, can I ask you about whether or not on this course you did anything about maintaining a discreet presence as you were going about your work?
Well, the hydro at Matlock was, it's very isolated, and it's up in the Derbyshire Hills. We were not confined to barracks. We used to go for walks round there, but we never met anybody. My father came there once, soon after I got there, with a suitcase of clothes, because obviously coming from the medical corps, I'd only got the clothes I stood up in. He brought a lot of shirts and a few civilian clothes for me. We were allowed to wear civilian clothes when we went outside. We didn't have to. There was no parades or anything like that, thank God. We were taught a great deal on this course about how to be discreet and how to allow other people to do the talking. And we were also warned that in the course of our duties we were bound to become involved with information which was not known to the public. And so that, for instance, when you went to a cocktail party and somebody was talking about, did you see that they beat up 10 E-boats in the channel last night and our chaps got back with no casualties at all? Well, as we'd probably put the story into the press to boost public morale, we had to pretend that we thought it was a jolly good thing instead of saying, oh, you don't want to believe stuff like that. And we were always, later on when I was in SOE, we were at least 3 weeks ahead of the news all the time, and it made it extremely difficult to carry on a normal conversation. I got notes in my diary that when I went home it was very embarrassing having to listen to their opinions about how the war was going when we knew that all their information was not accurate. And one just had to preserve a discreet silence and say, oh, so how interesting. I said, I didn't realize you knew all that, Daddy.
Did you ever slip up?
I don't know. It's when I read Nigel West's book, MI5, I suddenly realized that my father was involved in MI5 during the coal strike and afterwards. At the time, I didn't know anything about it. And also, when I got into the intelligence corps, I didn't realize that he'd written to Vernon Kerr and Stuart Mingus. Well, if he had done that, he could have easily found out that I was in SOE. And if he did know that I was in SOE, he never let on. And certainly, I never let on to him. And at one stage, my sister was very browned off for the canteen work she was doing in London, and I got her an interview at Baker Street. And I had to warn all the people that she was coming in, and I watched her come into the back of Michael House, which is the head office of Marks and Spencer's, where we were. And I watched her coming in. I had to stay in my office until the girl who was interviewing her rang through and said that she'd left the building, but she never knew that I worked there until after the war, or that I'd seen her going in and out. Yes, I suppose one was rather discreet. I really lived a sort of Jekyll and Hyde existence for 6 years, and as I'm a natural extrovert, it was a complete reversal of my natural feelings. And from the moment I went to Matlock, I stopped being an extrovert. and led this sort of double life. But then I like unorthodox things. I love intrigue. It's marvellous. It's fascinating, especially if you can do things which are legal, but which enables you to win a point without being found out. It's absolutely marvellous.
Is there anything else that you want to say about the security course?
Just before we left on the 7th of December, we had to sign our reports. And I was very excited when I saw that mine was a nice one, thank goodness. It read, good, reliable character, keen and conscientious, an attractive personality, recommended for security. So I left with joy in my heart and a recommendation to stir up my Spanish. Well, I think I forgot to say that I'd always been very keen on foreign languages because during the First World War we had refugee Belgian governesses and my mother had been brought up in Switzerland. And so my first language was French and I didn't speak any English till I was six. But after being educated in English prep school and public school, they had knocked most of it out of me. But I was still very fluent in French. And between Uppingham and Cambridge, I went to the Berlitz School in Sheffield and took Spanish and German for 6 months. And it's quite interesting. I got double the distance in Spanish that against German, I suppose, because Spanish is a Latin language, and I'd been classically educated on Latin and Greek at school. So the time I got to the intelligence corps, I was fluent in French, and I had a knowledge of Spanish, a smattering of German, which is not bad.
What type of work did you take up at the end of the course?
Well, we had no depot, and so we were all sent back to our homes to await posting. I got home on the Sunday morning, 7th of December, and I had a long, leisurely bath. And the telephone rang when I was still in the bath. My sister said, oh, quick, the War Office is on the phone. And so I wrapped myself up in a towel and went to the phone. Is that Mr. Lee? I said, yes, yes, sir. So you are to report to MI-11, room 136, Major Barry, at the War Office at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. So that was that. I thought I was going to have about 14 days happy, sort of leave with nothing to do. Instead of that, I had to pack up that afternoon. I caught the afternoon train to London, got in about 6:30, and there was an air raid on at the time. And I remember incendiaries were flaming away all down Piccadilly as my taxi negotiated these wretched things on the way to the Hyde Park Hotel. Quite extraordinary in those days how the cost of living was such, and one's modest income, I talk about modest income, before the war I was earning £3 a week. I had a little money of my own, but not very much. I could run a car. But you arrived in London, and you automatically went to the Hyde Park Hotel, because it was a nice hotel, and it wouldn't have cost very much, and go and have dinner in the Barclay and Savoy, and drink a bottle of whiskey at 400 all through the night. And this is sort of rather like buying postage stamps in those days. Inland Revenue really hadn't got after the drinkers and the smokers. Quite extraordinary.
Can you tell me a bit about your duties and your new job?
I duly reported to Major Barry, who was a charming man, a barrister, in room 136, MI-11. This was the military security branch of the War Office, and we were what you might call the coordinator of all field security activities on the military side, and straight army stuff. We had censor books that had been written and articles and things like that. I remember one book written by a man called John Baker White, who subsequently became an MP. I had to censor this. It was called It's Gone for Good. It was rather good. It was quite an interesting commentary on life from First World War up to the beginning of the Second World War, and how all the fun and games one had literally he wrote it out. He said, this is never going to come back again. And how right he was. Nice chap. I saw him about when he was about 18, had lunch with him about 10 years ago. He lives down somewhere near Maidstone now. I spent most of my time, you see, they had asked for a G3, which was a captain, and all they got was a second lieutenant, straight out of the counter-espionage course at Matlock. In those days, you automatically got two pips after we'd been commissioned for a fortnight, I think it was. So very soon after I got to the war office, I was a lieutenant. But even so, they wanted a captain of much more practical experience than I had. I had none. So I spent most of my time carrying officer-only files round the war office. And I was absolutely flogged out in the evening after these journeys, and I thought, I wonder how far I walked. And I took a pedometer with me one day, and I actually walked 11 miles in a day inside the war office carrying these wretched files from one office to another. Because other ranks, of course, were not trusted with secret documents. They had to be carried by officers. And in the course of my peregrinations, I met a tremendous number of extremely nice men. And I also penetrated two floors below ground into two very secret rooms. At least they appeared to be very secret. They were each staffed by a girl. One was enormously fat and great fun, tremendous extrovert, and always laughing and joking, and took her glasses away and she couldn't see her hand in front of her face, very blind. And the other one was cross-eyed, and you never knew who she was looking at. But she was extremely intelligent, very nice, and I got to know these girls very well. And they were a monument of discretion, and I could not discover what they were doing. I knew it was very secret. That was all I knew. And I knew that eventually I discovered that one of them had something to do with cloaks and daggers and parachutes. But I didn't know what it was. And the other one I deduced, because once you're in the intelligence corps, you're taught to think and to work things out. So I said to myself, well, this one is something to do with cloaks and daggers and sabotage. The other must be something to do with intelligence. And it transpired that I was absolutely dead right later on when I got to know about these things. Well, when I got to MI-11 in December 1940, I was then 27. I was in 1913. How well, 1913, 27, 28, was it? Coming up, 1941, I'd have been 28, wouldn't I? Yes, that's right. And I gradually got into this work, and I loved it, and there was an absolutely marvellous man there working with Rupert Barry, or Rupert Speer, S-P-E-I-R. Now, Rupert, after the war, he was a very staunch liberal, and he became a liberal MP, and he eventually finished up, I think, because he got a knighthood, and I think he finished up as managing director of Golden Wonder Crisps or something like that. But he was an absolutely splendid man. I remember one day, I got to know him very well indeed, and after I'd been there about 4 months, he threw an ink bottle across the room at me, landed on my desk and made an awful mess because there were no biro pens or anything like that. It was all ink in those days. And as he threw this thing, I said, my God, Peter, you've got the mind of a fifth-rate clerk. And he was absolutely dead right. Very penetrating mind he had. Dead right. I've got a sort of card index brain, which is idiotic. It's why I never got anywhere in this world. The other interesting thing about the War Office in those days, there was no central heating. And every office had a coal fire. And we were issued with a ration of coal every morning to keep warm the room up. Well, as 1940 came along, we were being bombed extensively during that time, and numbers of times sirens used to go about 6:45 at night, I remember, and we never left the War Office much before 7. So we were all traffic stopped, and we had to walk home, and I remember once I was walking home. I got as far as the Cromwell Road. I was living in just off Queensgate at the time. And so I was walking along, and I heard and a whole string of incendiaries came down right the way down Cromwell, the centre of Cromwell Road. And I was flat on my face in the mud. This was in January, February, I suppose. And when we saw what had happened, I just got up and walked on home. I was staying with some people called Margot and Slava Astafiev. I'll spell that later. Margot used to dance with Pavlova, and I remember seeing her dance at. She must have been with Pavlova's company. And in the early 20s, about 1923, my mother brought me up to London, and her company was dancing at the Maeskelyne and Devance Theatre in Upper Regent Street. Maeskelyne and Devance was a sort of magician show. Wonderful, they were very clever, but they couldn't keep the thing going all the time, so they used to have things there. And I remember watching Pavlova dance Lacine, which was absolutely stupendous. And on another occasion, my mother took me to Astafieva's a dance studio in Notting Hill, where I saw Patrick Kay, who's better known as Anthol Dolla, who was then quite young. Yes, 1923 would be. And I think Markova was there at the time too. She was only about 13. And I remember Patrick Kay doing cartwheels down the room and finishing up by kicking over the tea urn at the end of the room. Marvellous. So anyway, I was staying with Margot, who married Astafieva's son, Slava. And he was a white Russian. Very, very artistic. I mean, the most beautiful furniture and marvellous artist, but very strange. And I stayed there for quite a long time. And I was, after sort of walking home in the after the bo and during the bombing raids. And then I remember one morning we had a particularly heavy night. I think it was the night they set the East End of London on fire, and there was no transport at all the next morning at the War Office. And I literally crunched my way through glass all the way from South Kensington to the War Office. It's a tremendous mess. I think they tucked a few out on the West End just to keep our heads down. But I remember being up on the roof at in Queensgate there and watching the fire over London. It was absolutely incredible. That was the night when everything was flattened all round St Paul's. By that time, one had got inured to being bombed, and you just sort of, you know, when a raid started, you just went on doing whatever you happened to be in, playing bridge or something like that. And if you got hit or bombed out, it was bad luck. And you come to terms with that. You tend to lose all love of material things. I mean, I had a tremendous lot of books and records, and very soon after the war started, I just assumed that they wouldn't be there at the end of the war, and that I wouldn't have anything at the end of the war. Much easier to go through life like that, philosophically.
Now, coming back to your duties, you said how interesting it was, but so far you've only described these very humble duties of carting files about.
Well, I was doing this sort of censoring stuff, and it's terrible. You see, without keeping a diary, it's awfully difficult to remember the type of things that one did. I was only in MI-11 from December 40 until June 41, so it's only about 6 months. And I had two periods of leave during that time. I was the dog's body in the department, and so I was never involved in anything of any importance, because Barry did all the sort of senior stuff, and then Rupert Spear was a captain senior to me, so he got the stuff that Barry couldn't deal with, and I just got the rubbish, which really was carrying officer-only files. But obviously, I was doing much more than that. And there are one or two comments in my diary: interviewed so and so, and quite an interesting chap came in from Vichy France, and we had a bit of a guess about what was happening then. Very humble stuff.
What type of things were you censoring? Just any kind of publications?
Well, there's books, articles in newspapers, and anybody who wanted to was writing up their experiences at all for the papers or in book form would come to us for the clearance on the military security side. Nothing, no politics or anything like that. But anything that had anything to do with the war or military formations or things leading up to Dunkirk, I mean, obviously anybody who come out of Dunkirk burst straight into print because it was pretty hairy period there. I mean, we literally had nothing. If Hitler hadn't been such a clot, he'd come straight into England after Dunkirk. I mean, he'd only got to sort of come straight over in June and he'd have come in. There was nothing. The BEF lost all their equipment. We had hardly any aeroplanes. Our own hospital, 1,300-bedded general, 1,200-bedded general, we hadn't got a bandage when we left, nothing, just the clothes we stood up in.
Was there not a temptation in doing this censorship work to play on the safe side and perhaps censor things which needn't have been censored? Or was it fairly clear what had to be cut out?
No, we had guidelines, and you have to use your intelligence all the time, and you it's. I find now that people who know nothing about these things are bellyaching upon them about Official Secrets Act and this stupid girl who's just got 6 months. She richly deserved it. You don't sign the Official Secrets Act and then say, "Oh well, that doesn't apply to my conscience." And you either sign the Official Secrets Act or you don't. And if you don't want to sign it, then don't take the job. But if you've got conscience about things, don't sign. And don't do the job. Don't put yourself into a hopeless position. And that was the attitude that we had to take over all forms of military security. We had to play on the safe side, obviously. We didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know when Hitler was going to come in. Mind you, by December 1940, the invasion was off. He was beginning to turn his attentions toward Russia, and the Battle of Britain had been fought and won, and so he was obviously not going to come in. But we had to be very careful that we had to assume that no matter how good MI5 were, that there were still German agents operating in this country, and that, quote, walls have ears, unquote, and don't talk out of turn. Because you can never tell who's got a friend and who's going to write something to a neutral country, and the neutral country passes it on to somebody else. We're not a very security-minded nation. It's not in our nature to be secretive. And when you get involved in a war like this, where you've really got to put the clamps down, and you've really got to control the press, because my God, look at the way they behave now. The intrusion into people's privacy is absolutely disgraceful. And they try and do this, and they try to do it all through the Falkland Wars. They try to conduct the war through the press. Well, why hand it on a plate to the enemy? It's daft, isn't it?
Did you ever have any complaints because of the censorship that you carried out?
No.
People accepted it, did they?
Yes. We were fighting a war to the death. I found that later on when I got into SOE, I found that the regular operational mind was very anti-security. It's in the nature of things. If you're a chap involved in operations, whether they're secret or overt, you're an extrovert. You're out to go and, you know, you've got a gun and you go out and kill somebody. And you don't ask questions. And you take the view that if you can kill him first, you won't get killed. So what the hell's the point of being secretive about it? And trying to strike a balance between the real need for security so that it didn't interfere with operations was extremely difficult. We'll come on to that later.
Did you say that you were involved with conducted tours at this stage?
No, I used to take people around the War Office, yes, visiting brigadiers and all that sort of stuff. I used to, you asked me what my duties were, I just remembered now, people from military formations used to come up and we would be the conducting, or I would be a conducting officer to take them round to see whoever they wanted to see and make sure they didn't go into the right wrong rooms, because I mean we knew all the sensitive rooms. I used to have to do night duty, to take my turn on night duty in the War Office. I remember I was on night duty the night that Germany invaded Yugoslavia. And luckily I was the junior officer on duty, and so the senior chap rang up the CITS to say that the Germans had gone into, this was about 3 in the morning, gone into, or he rang up the DMI, that's right, the Director of Military Intelligence, and said the Germans had gone into Yugoslavia. So I thought you ought to know. He said, what the hell do you think I can do about it? Don't wake me up to bloody silly things like that. 9 o'clock tomorrow morning is quite early enough to hear about that. But he was obviously dead right. So he probably knew they were going in anyway.
How did you come to leave the job and take up a new post?
Well, our colonel in MI-11 was full of shrapnel from the First World War, and he was a very operational type. I think he was a cavalry officer. Can't remember his name. Might have been Russell. Can't remember. Charming man. And all operational officers reckoned that they'd rarely been put out to grass if they were put into an intelligence department. They thought there was bad news. They all wanted to be on MO, not in MI. MO is the military operations section of the War Office. And to be given a job in MI, they reckoned that, you know, they'd really failed in their duty. And he was a bit grumpy. And as I said, I was about 28 at the time. And by about March 41, April, end of March 41, I think it would be, he called me into his office one day. He said, I've decided I'm not going to have anybody under 30 sitting on their backsides in the War Office. I'm going to post you back to the depot so that you can be given more active employment. Perfectly natural thing to say. However, I'd got really hooked on security by this time, and I'd found these two rooms in the basement, and I thought, I can't bear the thought of going back to the depot and being posted out as a field security officer in some crummy unit. I must really try and find my own job. And so I said to the colonel, I said, sir, how long have I got before you're going to post me away? And he said, well, I thought about the middle of April. And I said, well, couldn't you make it the end of April, sir? He said, oh, all right, why, what's on your mind? So I said, well, would you have any objection if I tried to find my own a job that I'm really keen on doing? And he said, no. What do you think of doing? So I said, well, I was rather hoping to join either SOE or ISRB. He didn't bat an eyelid, except he said, rather like Busty Hearn, only being a gentleman, he said, I don't think you would be quite suitable for that sort of activity. If you remember, Busty Ham said, don't take things like you. So I said, well, anyway, so may I try? And he said, yes, do. Let me know how you get on. So this was middle of March or something like that. And as soon as I got out of his office, I went herring down to this room to see the big fat girl with the thick glasses. And I said, look, Elizabeth, the most dreadful things happened to me. The colonel's going to send me back to the depot for repo.